The Institute on Religious Life has brought you a series of taped lectures by one of today's leading theologians, Father John A. Hyden, S.J. And some of these taped lectures have proved difficult to understand because of surface or tape noise, or because of some sort of outside interference. And the problem of hearing and understanding is further accentuated when some of the users attempted to play these tapes on loudspeaker systems for the benefit of their communities. And for this reason, it has been necessary to retape certain of these lectures to assure clarity of voice and content. In such cases, we have had to resort to a substitute voice, but we assure you that the words spoken and the ideas presented are those of Father John A. Hyden, with nothing added or subtracted. The substitute voice is one of Robert Warnock. The current lecture is on training in religious poverty. As we enter this subject, a few clarifications would be, I think, in place. I don't suppose most religious really ask themselves too much about what poverty is. And maybe it is just as well. The important thing is to live poverty, as Thomas A. Kempis tells us. Much better to experience compunction, sorrow for sin, than to be able to define it. Although I would add, and I trust A. Kempis wouldn't mind, better to both understand compunction and practice it. So here with poverty. Of course, the practice of poverty is far more important than being able to define it. But if I can both define it and practice it, all the better. Now, this bears some emphasis, especially with those entering a religious community. If nothing else, having what religious life is and its expectations prescribed and defined early in the religious life, it helps a lot. Because you would then at least have some idea of what this is. It is much better to understand something and then set about practicing it. Better than practice by trial and error and then learn the hard way. And by that time, maybe disqualify one's self from religious life. In any case, we begin by saying that poverty is a virtue. This is not obvious, because poverty is a lot of things. We must assume that people entering the religious life already have some desire to practice poverty and some understanding of its meaning. The virtue of poverty, therefore, should be developed. Notice I said training in religious poverty. Let me first, then, distinguish three kinds of poverty. Poverty of precept, poverty of counsel, and poverty of perfection. Over the years, in teaching subjects like this, I try to reduce the key ideas to short phrases, and I hope they don't sound like clever phrases. Short so that they can be remembered and, of course, put into practice. What is poverty a precept? A good, simple, but accurate definition would be: it is that virtue which enables a person not to take what does not belong to him. What is the poverty of precept? The virtue of not taking. Don't take what belongs to someone else. That is the poverty of precept. And why precept? Because it is commanded by God. And what is the opposite? Stealing. Second, poverty of counsel. That means the virtue to share. If the precept is not to take, then counsel is to share. and what I have I share with others. What is the poverty of perfection? You would almost expect this. Poverty of perfection is to give up, in other words, or in a word, to sacrifice. I want to assure you, those are not just expressions. Needless to say, all three levels of poverty belong to religious life. And on all three levels, those entering the religious life, or even after years of membership, they must be trained in it. Precept, not to take. Counsel, to share. Perfection, to give up. What is the precept? The precept is part of the Old Testament. What are the two commandments of poverty of the Old Testament? Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not covet. And this is where stealing implies taking away what belongs to someone else, and coveting means desiring what does not belong to me. But we must add, because we are talking as Christians, Christ, needless to say, accepted the precept of poverty in the new law. However, what Christ did was to interiorize, intensify this precept of poverty. In other words, not are we not merely to not steal, but we must be convinced, as Christ wants us to believe, that this is part of God's will, that some people have more and others have less, and just because some have more and I have less, that does not give me a warrant for stealing. You might say the Christian understanding of the two commandments of the precept of poverty are resignation to God's will, resignation to divine providence in the dispossession of this world's goods, and a very hard precept that is. The poverty of precept, this requires effort to practice the poverty of precept, because we all like to possess. The child in his playpen who holds on to the rattle, all the way up to the millionaire who commits suicide, as I was told during the stock market crash of 1929. I was told by a man who should know that not a single Pullman rode into the Chicago railroad station without at least one suicide for a period of weeks. Rich people took their lives and used the convenient means of a Pullman ride to take their lives. They want to possess. Second, the counsel of poverty goes beyond the precept. It is part of the New Testament, and for all times has been associated by the Savior with the commandment to love. And I think some of these insights have got to be shared with people as we are training them, because these are not children. We are dealing with intelligent persons who need to know why they are doing what they are supposed to do, and not just jump through the hoops. In fact, their sister Imelda, 2 years ago, when we were planning the classes here, they ended up on alternate Saturdays. This is what she told me. Father, our sisters must understand religious life. Otherwise, they take their vows, even final vows, and then something happens. And one reason is this matter of poverty, and she sensed it. And she is the reason, by the way, we are having these Saturday and Sunday programs. They do not understand unless you appreciate and grasp the meaning of what you are doing. After a certain number of years, the novelty of religious life wears off, so that especially the young might have a strong, deep conviction, in this case of poverty, of its counsel. You don't just get that by repeating, be poor. The mind must somehow wrap itself around the mystery. It is a mystery. To understand it, as much as with God's grace we can. The counsel of poverty is part of the New Testament, the new commandment of Christ to love. If I love someone, I want to share. I want to share my possessions, my material possessions. I want to share my experiences psychologically. I want to share my ideas intellectually. The most pitiful spectacle in the world, I think, is an intelligent, selfish person. This is my definition of having a big head. Bursting with ideas, and you can get some of it if you pay. Consequently, this poverty of counsel is the commandment of love shown in sharing. Evidently, the more I love, the more I will want to share. And religious, and I would say the sooner the better, they must be trained. And being still, you might say, undeveloped neophytes, there will be all sorts of signs of selfishness. Religious must be trained to share. And among the problems that this sharing in religious life, I think, exists because people are so different, is that no two people who enter the community either have the same amount of money when they enter or the same background in their family. Some come from the slums or their equivalent, and some come from the suburbs. I would recommend and I would insist that this be practiced throughout life, and that whatever a religious receives, he or she never keeps for themselves. And it is not easy, as you know, especially when you face the parents who might be offended if he or she will not be able to use. Parents and friends are problems. It is just the size she wears. It is just what she likes to eat, or whatever it is. And I am talking especially about the young. First of all, I think the attitude should always be, no matter how long they are in religious life, the attitude should be that whatever I get, I intend to turn in. I do not want to keep. I want to share. And there are plenty of opportunities in a lifetime to live up to that desire. But mature religious, this would make sense, that the person is willing to give it up. Now, this watch I'm wearing, I turned in this watch. It was given to me for my ordination. It is still keeping time. So I went to the superior shortly after ordination and turned in this perfectly good watch. But I did need a watch, so the superior said he would see what he has got, and so he gave me a wristwatch, and I wore it, and it stopped. He gave me another, and that stopped too. At any rate, he ended up by saying, "Now look, either something happens to the watches or something is wrong. Take your watch back." And I think I even argued with him. I still have it. But the willingness to share is of the essence of practicing the poverty of counsel. And I think for younger religious, this is my opinion, I think not to share, not to have the occasion not to share, should be the rarest exception. Otherwise, they remember. It becomes part of their spiritual chromosomes, you might say, if they have not been trained from the very beginning to share. If they have certain needs that have to be supplied, let the community supply them. Finally, the perfection of poverty. I call the poverty of perfection a higher degree of the poverty of counsel. We are told by Christ and shown by him how pleasing this is to him. What are we saying? Not merely to not appropriate what belongs to someone else. That is poverty of precept. Not merely to share what I have with someone else. That is poverty of counsel. But to give up what I have a natural and even a divine right to possess myself. This is really imitating the Master, who gave up everything. And as we know from Revelation, he began to practice poverty by giving up all to what he had a claim to as God, a mystery we don't fully understand. To take upon himself, as Paul told the Philippians, the form of a slave. And by the way, something which we should keep repeating, that word in the Greek is slave, who is owned by his master and owns nothing himself. That is Christ, who allowed himself to be totally owned by the Father, and himself, his will, was to do only what the Father wants. It is here that I think each community, first of all, should look to its practice of poverty in the community, because one of the hardest things I am told by the young religious, and I know and have come into contact with enough young religious to know what I am saying, it is to be taught one thing in the postulancy or novitiate and see something else when they take their vows, especially in this matter of poverty. The scandal regarding poverty won't come from the outside. It will come from the inside. And this is where every member of the community must cooperate. Otherwise, you are going to lose the vocations you've got, or you won't get others because they will not be edified by what they see. What then does this poverty of perfection consist in? It means first, obviously, giving up in affection, giving up in detachment, surrendering my heart, that my will lets go. It is practicing the commandment, thou shalt not covet, on its highest level. But that is not all. There is enough writing nowadays about interior poverty to have misled a lot of religious driving around in expensive cars, dolled up in the finest fashions, as one mother general nearby here. As soon as she was elected, she moved into a ranch-style home with her council away from the mother house. The poverty of perfection is not merely interior. It is not merely affective. It is also exterior. It must be factual poverty, actual poverty, real poverty. A religious must practice the poverty of perfection by not having what those who are not religious possess and might rightly own and enjoy. This, in fact, the not being merely detached, but the giving up, is the proof of my sincerity of detachment. When I read, or tell me, or people tell me, they hear, this is religious, that we have now learned that the essence of poverty is in detachment. So I can own, I can possess, but provided my heart is detached, that is what the perfection of poverty consists in. Not so. Not so. Of course, there are people who are actually poor who are not detached. Who doubts it? But religious poverty is both interior detachment and external removal. I remove these from my life. Now, the problem, of course, is that no two communities here are quite the same. By now, we have seen enough in our course on the history of religious life to know that there are certain degrees of this actual, factual poverty in different communities. And I think we have to consider this whole matter. First, the general rule, and then the beginning of some explanation. The basic norm that the Church has given us for the practice of poverty of perfection in the religious life is the nature of the community. What is its charism? And that is especially shown in the kind of apostolate that a given community exercises. Depending on the nature of the community, on the kind of work the community is engaged in, the kind of people it is meant to serve, its poverty in terms of detachment, well, it should be complete, but in terms of external, doing without, or not having, or not using, it will differ from one constitution to another constitution. In general, religious orders are expected by the Church to practice complete dispossession. Thus, no one in the community owns anything. Religious orders, technically, might be partly defined as orders wherein complete dispossession is of the essence. Congregations, on the other hand, and secular institutes that take simple vows are not expected by the Church to practice the policy of total dispossession. Now, we are dealing here with internal and external poverty. Not merely detachment of the heart, but the doing without, and how that is determined by the charism of the different communities. We might repeat the importance of recognizing that we not only take the vow of poverty, but that poverty is a virtue in which we are meant to grow. And in fact, I would say that one of the sure signs of a person having a vocation is that he or she shows signs of growing in the spirit or the virtue of poverty. We have explained the three levels of poverty. Poverty of precept, not to take. Poverty of counsel, to share. The poverty of perfection, to give up, to sacrifice. The precept is part of revelation. It is in the Old Testament, in the Decalogue, in the 7th and 10th commandments, and it was deepened and extended by Christ in the New Testament. In essence, the precept of poverty is to accept God's providence in my life regarding material possessions, or more accurately, material non-possessions. No two people are born into this world with the same amount of material possessions. With some of us, the parents went into debt, and perhaps by our second birthday, the debt is paid off. Some are born into poverty. Others are born into wealth. I must recognize God's providence in my not having what someone else next door, across the street, in my class that has everything. This is especially true for the young postulant who comes from a family situation where they enjoyed a great deal of this world's possessions. Secondly, the poverty of counsel. It is part of the New Testament, a part of Christ's commandment to love. And if I love someone, I want to share. And I not only share, but I want to share. How is poverty practiced in the different religious communities? First, in general. The Church's understanding of poverty for all religious is that they practice the precept, the counsel, and the perfection of poverty. Consequently, the difference is mainly on level number 3. Every human being, and not only a Christian, is required by divine law to practice the precept of poverty, which means substantially, don't steal, either with your hands or with your eyes. Religious are also to practice the counsel of poverty, namely to share. There is no religious life unless the members share. Quite literally, what belongs to one belongs to all. Which, by the way, is not that easy to put into practice, especially since people's wants always exceed their needs. I couldn't think of a more important function for a superior or one who is directing persons in religious life to train them to be satisfied with less and to leave up to the community to meet their needs. In fact, I am told that in the secular world, you can get some pretty good ideas of the kind of person an individual is, say, being interviewed for a job. A man whose wife brings herself and her children for a periodic confession from New Jersey. They come into New York. He is personnel director for a large corporation. He is not the only one, but people in personnel tell me one of the safest ways to find out what kind of a person he or she is to whom you are planning to hire, what kind of a person he or she is going to be, is what they do with their money. The most revealing feature of a person, and these are people who are professionally in personnel work, the most revealing feature is how does the person use his money. So if in the secular world money or economics reveals character, believe me, it is especially revealing in religious life. I don't just mean currency, money in the technical sense, but material possessions. You can almost identify formation with training in religious poverty. Taking a person who may be very sensitive about getting permission for whatever he or she needs, but say she is careless in the use of things which are for the whole community. Take, for example, a person who finds certain equipment unsatisfactory, the heat in the summer oppressive, the cold in the winter hard to bear. If you stop to think of it, there is no single virtue that does not have an economic base. Every virtue that we are bidden to cultivate in ourselves and in others is somehow tied in with material possessions. You remember the severe cold in Chicago, sustained low temperatures. And I think of the longer sustained period, the longest in New York history, of below freezing, Well, the Missionary Sisters of Charity, where I teach in the Bronx and where I was last Thursday, they just decided on their own the thermometer would never rise above 60. All I know is that whenever I came, the temperature was a comparable 70, but the longer I stayed, the temperature kept dropping. So everything in our religious lives somehow is connected with economics. People who have money, communities that have money, will provide. Watch it. Watch it. Watch it. 5 or 10 years later, after they have entered the community, you will wonder what happened. I will tell you what happened. They are softened. Endurance, being willing and able to take it, I am speaking physically, is too closely identified with poverty. We are not too prompt as a community to re-examine our collective conscience on this practice. On the third level of this poverty, no two communities are quite the same. First of all, there are religious communities which, by canonical definition, require their members to be dispossessed of whatever they may have brought into the community. Dispossession is required for all solemn vows. You cannot take solemn vows before you take your last vows. You give up everything you own, and you make sure it is legally valid and that there are no strings attached. For example, even to give what a person may own to his or her relatives is forbidden according to the solemn vow of poverty. The solemn vow of poverty takes Christ's statement to the rich man quite literally. Go sell what you have, give your proceeds to the poor, and then come follow me. However, as I think we mentioned in one of our conferences, most communities and congregations have a simple vows. They do not require dispossession. But lest we overlook the fact that whatever else the Second Vatican Council did, it tightened the practice of religious poverty. How so? Ecclesiae Sanctae has a provision for chapters. This is Pope Paul VI, in which the Holy Father, on August the 6th, 1966, in a motu proprio, published himself on his own authority, covering 4 major decrees of the Vatican Council. In Ecclesiae Sanctae, when explaining and implementing Perfecte Caritatis, Paul VI declares that the chapters that are currently revising their constitutions are encouraged to re-examine their legislation on poverty, and that if they wish, and they are encouraged to do so, they may not only, and I have yet to see a single congregation that has done this, not only allow the religious to dispossess themselves at or after last vows, but Ecclesiae Sanctae declares the chapter may obligate the community. 14 years later, I don't know a single community that has been that generous. It is as though the church has not spoken. These are not trivial matters. When I see communities lush with property, square miles of land, beautiful buildings, and empty novitiates. Well, look, I'm among friends. I am speaking from my heart. We must. We absolutely must, as a matter of survival, in today's affluent society, as community, we either give witness to collective poverty, or God's grace will not even allow us to survive. 5 years of many intimate conversations with Mother Teresa has convinced me of this. The only communities that will survive are those who take their poverty very seriously, and those so educated. We have read so many books. We know all the answers. And many communities have by now been practicing all the evasions. The Roman Catholic Church, speaking through the Vicar of Christ, wants to restore poverty to what it was for 1,500 years until the Reformation. And at that time, when for reasons best known to the Holy Spirit, no doubt to make it possible, especially for women, that's how it got started under Vincent de Paul in 1637, the first Roman approved congregation with simple vows, which then meant a simple vow of poverty, which further means that you may own. And you do indeed practice the poverty of sharing and dependence. There is no religious life without that. Poverty of doing without. Poverty of dispossession. It is in Ecclesiae Sanctae, and you should ask yourselves, didn't the delegates to our chapters read those statements? A society like America has spoiled us in so many ways, and none more surely than in the matter of poverty. The moment you travel outside of the country to Europe, and most of all in Asia, if ever a person complained about not having, well, they would feel he is committing a mortal sin. The destitution, the dire need of most of the human race. Next month, I am giving a lecture on the language revolution in the Catholic Church. A poor Mexican uses the word poverty. We speak of poverty. We don't know how many, but when I was in Rome, upwards of 500,000 people lived with no shelter. In India, millions have no roof over their head. So what is poverty? Is it a word? Is it somebody's mental idea? Is it what God wants it to be? We must think about this. We must re-examine poverty, its meaning. We have to learn the meaning of poverty in a society that has canonized wealth. The fight against justice, of course. But we must recognize the really true meaning of poverty. This is the wealthiest nation on earth. It is the wealthiest nation in the whole history of time. We better be poor. We better do without. At this point, one of the brothers raised a question concerning the value of solemn vows, which he felt certainly was deeply in question at this point of history. If the superior, for instance, was lax, even though the order divests itself completely of its property, individual persons or religious could still own or have much. And Father Hardin's reply, the superior in many ways is the key to the interpretation of poverty, really more than any other virtue, even obedience. Because you do have rules and regulations, and you don't have to have someone always telling you. For instance, if I want something and I don't have the money for it and depend on the superior for the handout, and it's a day-to-day experience, fairly constant, it's impressed on the mind. Let me say, as one who has tried to live the vow of poverty in a community, and it pains me to say it, a community that has been widely secularized, the Society of Jesus is in great need. But I think I know St. Ignatius and understand what he and other founders had in mind. There are certain things that happen with this dispossession. Before you finally dispossess yourself, remember these are your final vows. The act of will that you make to give up for the rest of your life, never to own anything, is supernaturally traumatic. You have to go through the experience to know what I am talking about. You are never again to own anything. And you sign formal documents, both legally and canonically. It purifies the soul as no other vow can. Because there are myriads of things you are anxious to get because you have access to getting them. And you give that up. Secondly, if the dispossession is faithfully practiced, it will be practiced not just by the individual, but by the community. And when I see a community, or a community after community, accumulating a lot of wealth, I realize the care that must be taken. As an example, a very successful set of books for the first 8 grades, a text for the children, and a manual, a teacher's manual, given to both the teacher and the parent. I was talking to Father Flaherty about this on the occasion of making a plane trip with him on returning to Chicago. This successful series has given the sisters $600,000 in royalties. Now, don't get me wrong, they deserve it. I am not begrudging them one penny. In my case, I don't belong to the Chicago province. I belong to the Detroit province. They have to support me. Whatever money I make, whatever checks I receive, they are endorsed over to the Detroit province of the Society of Jesus. It is almost 10 years that I have worked with this school series heretofore mentioned. Technically, I might have demanded a share in the royalties. Technically, I would not have been able to retain the money, but at least I would have had the satisfaction of endorsing over and or of getting a share. In 10 years, I have not received a penny. But I would also have been out of my mind to think that I had a right to it. All I know is you take a vow which dispossesses. Of course, you have to keep it. You just don't take it, you keep it. Then whatever you do because God wants you to do it, whether you get paid for it or not. And what a difference that makes. In any case, the community itself develops a sense of dispossession, which I pray that more communities will develop. Because communities in the United States, well, some are very rotten. Before we finish this poverty, and this is still an answer to your question, brother, the latest ruling of the Internal Revenue. I had to read it twice to make sure I was not reading a book in canon law. You know what the Internal Revenue is now doing? It is distinguishing among religious between those who have taken solemn and those who have taken only simple vows of poverty.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.